Hey, Ron, I made an Ardent Development Podcast sticker for my laptop, but I had to order a whole bunch of them, and now I have more than will fit on my laptop, and my wife won't let me use the extras to decorate the walls of the home office, so I need something to do with them. I was thinking we could give them to friends of the podcast who have left us a rating or a review in iTunes. What do you think?
That is a great idea. So, friends of the podcast, if you're enjoying listening, then please help us out. We would like you to go to ardentdev.com/iTunes. Now, that's going to take you to our iTunes page. It will forward you right along. Click on ratings and review. Do your thing there. Take a little screen print. Send that screen print to podcast@ardentdev.com with your physical mailing address, and we will send you a sticker. It's as easy as that. Problem solved.
You're listening to the Ardent Development Podcast with Ron Smith and Derek Hatchard. Whatever your role in the software development industry, join them in the search for inspiration and insights as they talk with practitioners and thought leaders from the world of tech and beyond. Visit ardentdev.com to subscribe to new episodes.
Welcome to the Ardent Development Podcast. I'm your host, Derek Hatchard.
And I am Ron Smith. Today we have Daniel Forkosh, who is the principal lead at Salesforce. Daniel's going to be talking to us about his experience with Salesforce, taking a team from manual testers into the automated testing space and the cultural changes that came along with that. So welcome, Daniel. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ron. Thanks, Derek. Thanks for having me.
Now, would you be able to get us started by just briefly talking about, you know, how did you find yourself in IT? And then how did you transition into this area, specifically around working with teams to get them into the automation space?
Sure. So I actually did not study computer science in school. I was a math major and I was going to be an actuary. And my first job was really just to be a quality engineer on a team while I was studying to be an actuary. During that time, earlier on in my career, I noticed that, you know, web development and really just testing web applications was still very, very young. And at the time, you know, teams were really transitioning from a waterfall process to an agile. I'm sure you guys can remember those days.
And
yeah, and regression testing was one of those really cumbersome manual efforts that companies just really accepted was going to be the bottleneck of the whole process. And so, and what I found at the time when I was doing that work, I noticed that testing was, again, as I was young, there really weren't many pioneered strategies. There really weren't any like best practices defined. It was just pretty much go through your pass fail, and that's the way it goes. And honestly, the way I saw it, the field was pretty undervalued and at times underappreciated, and really did not draw the best talent in the industry. And in fact, most quality engineers couldn't code. And so ultimately, I saw a fundamental issue with this. So the question that I always thought is, how can you expect a tester to really truly dig in and challenge what developers do in the work if they don't understand it and if they can't relate to it? So immediately I saw the opportunity to make an impact by really pushing to raise the technical bar for myself and the people around me. And so I started to learn how to code, getting more involved with sort of the architectural and the entire system. And I was very lucky. I was very fortunate to have a manager who really showed me the ropes and really showed me sort of how to do things. And he was very patient with me. And that was very awesome. And so over time, I noticed that the quality of my work really changed. And I stopped performing sort of repetitive tasks. And I started to write scripts. And I started digging into the code base and the databases and really challenged the requirements a lot better. And obviously that led to more positive results, and that was really, really, really awesome. And so as I progressed through my career, you know, I took that experience and I would usually be hired to develop a framework. I was usually the automation guy coming into different companies. And when I joined Salesforce, I was hired to really help drive test automation. And what I found at Salesforce, and even my companies before that, was that The challenges around the cultural challenges really far outweighed the technical ones.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, you know, the main challenges weren't really about the frameworks, right? Developers, any developer could really build a test harness, but it was really about getting the people to adopt these automation practices and test smarter and not necessarily harder. So that was the tricky part. So and with that, the real tricky part was to really enable quality engineers to really preserve their quality skills, not lose that, but also learn sort of the skills of a developer. And in essence, creating the best of both worlds, a sort of hybrid engineer.
I think it does create the best of both worlds, actually. Most of the best brightest developers I've worked for, often they spent some time in the testing world. And I find that when they're building their code now, they're thinking in advance, you know, how is this going to be tested? How can I prove that it works?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a more holistic way of development.
How did you get people to adopt the new way? What were the learnings that you came up with as you were working with these groups?
It's a very good question. And so I really outlined a lot of, from these experiences, I outlined 70 really key things that really helped establish this. And so the first one was really to get in there with them and really lead by example. So, you know, taking back from my experience with my first manager, he would get in there with me, he would show me, and I would see that it could be done. It would really alleviate some fears. And so at Salesforce and at companies before that, I would join the teams, do some peer programming, get in there with them and work with them. That was one of the big things. The other aspect is you need support from leadership. So, and that was one of the awesome things we had at Salesforce as well, is I had a great manager. Then my manager's manager really supported what I did and really supported this culture shift. And so it had to come from the bottom, right? Getting involved with everyone, but it also had to come from the top, and having both levels of support is really needed to accomplish this.
Well, it's interesting because I can recall a couple of times in my career where there was an attempt to have a group of developers or testers to work differently to follow this process. And if you had someone that was actually going to get engaged in a project team, it worked so much better. When you had someone that was almost ivory tower saying, you know, you will follow these processes, and they weren't involved in a project team, it didn't get adopted.
Yeah, you have to be. Otherwise, you really need to know why you're doing it. You need to feel part of it. So in between that, so having support from leadership, getting involved with them. So in between that, you want to sort of build bridges with other people that can help support and sort of amplify your efforts. You want to sort of evangelize a particular sort of brand or a particular way of doing things. And that's how you'll spread the word. And so, and this is very applicable for big companies when you have many different offices. So one of the things we did was we really established a presence in each office, really. And we all kind of got together and spread the word in a consistent manner. So we built bridges with the surroundings. So that was very, very important. And for the technical things, you really want to build a framework that accommodates the testers' needs. And so when you're there with them, the fourth point is really to build that framework that suits their needs first. So you don't have to over-architect anything crazy in the beginning. Kind of do it the agile way, where build something that works, iterate on it, understand what they're going to do and what they need, and continue to build from there. And so taking that approach is very, very, very useful. And because the key is to get the adoption part first, mm-hmm. and then you can start building spaceships.
Building the spaceships. So did you find, what was that shift like? Because I'm assuming that you were dealing with manual testers who were then learning the craft of automated testing. So did that change even in your hiring practices?
Oh, of course. And that's a huge thing that needs to be, that's another part of it, is that you need to start looking for that hybrid type of engineer. And we, before we used the word hybrid engineer, we used the term unicorns. We're looking for unicorns. So you want to have someone who has that best of both worlds. And it's really hard to find someone like that, because generally developers, you know, the type of questions you ask on an interview are, you know, do you understand object-oriented principles? How would you implement this code? And that's that. And they would leave the testing portion out of it, and vice versa. You know, on a testing interview, you would say, okay, how would you test this? What are some test cases you would do? How would you plan for this? And those are sort of mutually exclusive in the different interviews that you have. So you want to find someone who can really fit the mold for all those type of questions. And so the interviewing process changed where, again, on the quality side, the technical type of questions and asks would definitely go up. The bar would be raised. So it definitely changed the hiring process. And because we did hire the new blood really that came in with that mold, did help shift the culture of the company. That was a big part of it. So it was a lot of sort of helping people learn manual testing, learn automated testing from manual, but also bringing in people who fit that mold.
And there's an interesting aspect there, Dan, which you referenced before, which is having those people in all of your locations. When you're in a multi-office team, it can be hard to get buy-in. It can be hard to really observe and, you know, help to walk with the team and bring them along to success when you're hundreds or thousands of miles away.
Yeah. That was hard, right? And I was fortunate. And again, the support from leadership really helped build a team, really, build a team of bridge builders. And that's what we were. And so my team eventually became a team of bridge builders where we would support the framework and we would support the people and the adoption. And each one of these people would get in there with the people and establish relationships and figure out what they need. And mainly also the other thing to sort of touch on is when you do that, you start understanding sort of where they're coming from. You start understanding, okay, some of these people are scared. Why didn't they ever learn automation? Why did they ever learn how to code? They feel like they can't do it. And so there is a level of emotional intelligence that goes into this, sort of referencing one of the other podcasts you guys had. Right. So when you get in there with the people, you get to understand where they're coming from, and you get to see that, you know, sometimes they're scared of learning of coding. And so part of being a bridge builder, you have to come with some emotional intelligence and weigh in sort of, are they intimidated? Get them to feel confident getting on board and learning this. So that's another key to getting people to adopt.
So was there a portion of the people that you were working with that really wanted to stay in the manual space, for whatever reason, didn't want to make the leap, or just the skill set was broad?
That is a very, very good question. And yes, and they we still have those people. And one of the misconceptions in when you try to culture shift the organization is that when you shift things from manual to automated, one of the misconceptions is that now that we're doing things automated way, there's no more need to do anything manually anymore. It's just right. Now we're just automating everyone and we're all becoming robots. And that's the thing. If you do that, you eventually all become robots, and you don't want to necessarily have a team of robots. You still need people who think and do things. So there's a ton of value actually that for people who do not automate as well. There is a place. I do believe that there is a place for manual testers and people who exclusively manually test. And so just because you're not a strong automator, and the reason is just because you're not a strong automator doesn't mean you cannot contribute quality, because there are special people who have a very broad domain knowledge of, and that can go a long way. And so what I found with a lot of these people that do have this large, broad domain knowledge and are very good manual testers, the value they bring is they're good at tightening the communication gap between sort of development and product. And they help ensure sort of acceptance criteria is complete, and they make sure they're understood and not ambiguous. They're assertive. They ask good questions, and they help developers sort of get those requirements down. And the other thing is that a lot of these people are very organized. The manual tester generally they're very organized and generally, and a good manual tester would have a good testing strategy, and that brings a lot of value to the table. So to really sum it up, it's being able to organize and drive a good testing strategy, but it's also to be that good communicator with a good broad domain knowledge and can pinpoint things and see things that many people can't. So there still is room for that. And actually, one more thing that popped up in my mind, obviously, is exploratory testing. That still is important. And that should not go away. And people should be, and there are experts at that. So you shouldn't let test automation sort of cloud the importance of things like exploratory testing.
Hey, this is Derek and Ron, just taking a quick break from the interview so we can tell you how you can support the podcast. Now, if you've been listening for a while, you know that Ron and I are huge fans of Audible. We have both been members for many years, and today we have a couple of books recommended by our guest, Daniel Forkosh. Ron, do you want to share those?
Sure. The first book that Daniel mentions in the interview is titled Why Motivating People Doesn't Work and What Does. This is a book written by Susan Fowler. So Dan talks about this in his work in trying to get people to go through a culture shift. He said it was very valuable. The second book that Dan recommends is a book called Brief, Make a Bigger Impact by Saying Less. He found this to be obviously useful and has been trying to make his conversations more concise. So check these books out.
All right, you can download either of these books for free or another audiobook of your choosing by going to ardentdev.com/audible. That's ardentdev.com/audible. And now back to the interview. Dan, can you paint a picture for us? You said that exploratory testing is important. Manual testing has a place. Test automation is valuable. You got into it because you saw its value. Mm-hmm. Can you paint a picture for us of a healthy, functional organization and what the mix and blend of roles are and what people are doing and sort of when the machine is well-oiled and well-tuned and just rolling along, what does that big picture look like in terms of an organization?
Oh, that's a really good question. As you sort of walk through the SDLC a bit, and then if you narrow down to a sprint, say, within a sprint, a team brings on user stories and it starts out there. I mean, quality begins there. And when you hear the term sort of building quality into the product, it's really about starting to think about the quality of the product before a line of code gets even written. And so in the beginning of a sprint, say sprint planning or a backlog grooming type of session, when the team is onboarding a user story, a healthy team would talk about, they would talk about the implementations, they would talk about risks that are involved, but they would talk about sort of how this is going to be tested. And they'd collaborate on that and they would document that. They would trace the testing to the user story. And that's a critical thing. And that should be transparent across the team. And so in a healthy environment, you have developers, product owners, and quality engineers or hybrid engineers or a mix of everyone on the Scrum team would basically weigh in on how they would test this product. And that all starts with acceptance criteria, right? So the product owner would paint the picture of, what does the business need? But beyond that, how do we test that this thing is going to work and how are we going to try to break it? And so that's where it really begins. And then as that happens, you go and you the developers start implementing the feature. And as that happens, you start understanding how things start coming together. Things change a bit, right? In the agile world, things come up and the tests will change with it. And once the product starts coming together, you start understanding, what's a regression test now? Like after I've tested this and ran into a bunch of loopholes, I start understanding the risk of this in the big picture as things are going to get integrated. You start defining what regression is. Now, this whole time, you're manually testing. So when you said exploratory testing and even manual testing, even the tests that you've defined, you're in there in a dev environment working side by side, manually testing and scripting at the same time. But before you can script, you need to know what it is that you're going to do for regression testing. So as you kind of walk through sort of your sprint and you define what a regression test will be, you make time to automate it. You work with the team to automate that. And then you iterate sprint over sprint. And then every day, your regressions pack updates and changes as the next release sort of candidate gets matures anytime a new line of code comes in. So your regression changes every day. automation happens every day, but only after you've defined sort of what needs to be tested and what regression is. And you rinse and repeat. And then when you're ready to release, you can now lean on the fact that your regression tests have run every day. And in essence, you have a release ready to go. Now, all that is tangled in with a continuous integration system that leverages unit tests and integration tests way well before these typical manual regression or automated regression tests run.
Important question for you, and I've heard many different opinions on this one, which is when it comes to doing some of that initial manual testing and then building my automated tests, same person who's coding the feature or a different person than the person who coded the feature, and why?
Anytime you write something, whether you write an email, you need another set of eyes to look at it, right? That's you get a lot of value by having someone else look and critique and see, and try to find gaps in things that you haven't seen. And so for that reason, I would say it's imperative that someone else on the team tests your code, whether it's automated or manual.
And what do you say to the naysayers who look at your truly cross-functional Scrum teams, or I'll just say Agile teams instead? So you mentioned hybrid engineers. For people who aren't familiar with that term, that concept is that it's somebody who does all parts of the process. They interact with the product manager, they write code, they do testing. Everyone is responsible for the same set of things on the team. What do you say to the naysayers who say, no, some people have a real testing mindset. We can't, we have to have these separate functions within the team because my experience tells me that's how it works best. What do you say to those people?
And so, I mean, what I say to those people is don't misinterpret the term hybrid engineer. And the way I see it is I kind of agree a bit with those naysayers are saying, where, I mean, you can't remove the fact that someone's a specialist. You know, we're still humans and people are better at one thing or another. But what I'm saying, I think what the term hybrid engineer is, at least to me, is to not be in your own little corner and just focus on that one thing, because you're part of a bigger thing. You're part of the entire, building out the entire product. So, I mean, it doesn't just go into development and QE, but it's also understanding the business side of things. And hybrid engineer is a holistic understand sort of a little bit of everything. And to me, you can never take away what people are really good at, and you should never do that. So on a Scrum team, say, yeah, you may have people who are better at front-end development than back-end development. And it doesn't mean you can't have somebody else jump on and work on certain things. But who your experts are. And I think in reality, that it's always going to boil down to that.
All right, good answer. So stepping back a little bit, big picture, if we talk about transforming testing culture and going from a manual testing environment, or heaven forbid, an environment where there's kind of no testing and it's just developers send stuff straight into production, which does exist out there. In trying to transform culture and bring and mature the testing environment in terms of the way that we do testing, automating our testing, especially automating our regression testing, what are the pitfalls and what advice do you have for organizations that need to undergo that kind of transformation?
Yeah, so another good question. So so as going through this, in my experience, with anything, like even you mentioned the term hybrid engineering, you can take a concept and you can beat it to death. And automation isn't one of those things that you should do. And so a lot of the pitfalls are from people forgetting the roots of testing. So, automating everything under the sun just because it's cheap, quote unquote, isn't necessarily the right way to go. Don't become a robot. Don't forget about test planning. So like in the picture that we painted about in the very beginning, talk about testing, write it down first, do it manually a little bit first, try to understand sort of the big picture and be patient with it. Don't just go straight to, got to automate everything. Right. So, and don't get carried away with the metrics either. So a lot of companies they try to measure the progress metrics on how many test cases do we have. That happens both in manual and automated. But on the automated side, they say, oh, look, we have 1,000,001 test cases running every day. Well, okay, what's the actual coverage? Are you actually covering risks there? And so to me, 10 really great tests that you've defined out what the risks are and what the coverage is far outweigh 10,000 bad ones. So it's not just about the numbers. So that's one of the big ones. And like I said kind of earlier, test automation doesn't necessarily mean no more manual testing. Before automation comes the manual, leave room for exploratory testing, let things kind of come together and sink in as well. And I think the last thing I would say is that, actually two more things that I can think of is, one is just because you're a strong test automator doesn't necessarily mean you're a great quality engineer. It's not just about that. So as if you're managing a team and you have a quality engineer on your team and it's only about automation, that doesn't paint the full picture of that person's work as a quality engineer. So you want to weigh things about their testing strategies, how are they augmenting development, do they know what to test and how to test. And lastly, I want to talk about, I guess, the definition of done, and test automation itself sometimes can become a bottleneck. Sometimes teams put so much onus. So in the beginning, when we were doing the hybrid transformation, the way leadership tried to support this was they said, okay, definition of done, everybody needs to automate one test. And what ended up happening was people got overwhelmed and they started trying to checkbox that requirement and say, okay, we automated something. And that kind of got away from actually, not being a robot. So you have to be careful when you do things like that.
It's kind of the equivalent of writing a bunch of unit tests and they just all return true no matter
what. Yeah, exactly. And this goes, when we talk about test automation too, generally we've been talking about, the typical traditional manual test that a quality engineer would run, sort of those top of the pyramid tests, right? The black box testing that you would do. But this applies to, I think, to unit tests and integration tests that you would find in the code base as well. As you tighten those up, you're less likely to find issues later on.
The future of test automation and quality engineering, what's your spin on that?
We kind of talked about the sort of the hybrid worlds, as more companies are, transitioning and changing their culture to doing things more automated. And again, it's not just the testing, it's about continuous delivery. It's about all the advancements in the way, or these new ideas about microservices and just the way they're doing the team, companies do deployments and things like that. Test automation will fit into all that very nicely in the delivery cycle. So that's the future is going to be there. So I think they won't necessarily need to be as much culture shifting. As I said in the beginning, it's still a very young field. The internet is still, I think, still young in a way. So things are changing and teams are going to be able to leverage the fact that they have engineers that can all automate now. So now what? Let's make the development lifecycle go. So there's a lot about the delivery pipeline that I think that we'll see in the future. We're going to be able to leverage the fact that the cultures have changed already. And so now we can start using those automated tests as part of our delivery pipelines.
So Daniel, I wanted to ask you if you had any book recommendations. Do you have any favorite authors or books that are worth the read on some of these topics?
So one of the books... So Why Motivating People Doesn't Work and What Does. So this one's a book by Susan Fowler, and this one really helped me understand why people do things, what makes them do things. So everyone's pretty incentive based, and so when I started thinking, okay, I got to change the culture here. What moves people? And so this really helped me understand sort of how to get people motivated. And there's some really cool things in this book that goes into sort of, again, what moves people, what incentives drive them, and it's more about more than just giving people more money. It's about providing an environment for them so that they feel like they're part of things. So it's a really good book, and it helped me with understanding how to get people to buy into something. And the brief one is something I work on every day. And I try to be concise. And in a world where people have short attention spans, people are very busy, people are multitasking, and how do you get the point across in a concise way without rambling on?
Before we let you go, Daniel, can you let people know where they can find you online, maybe even if they wanted to follow up and ask you a question about the work that you've done?
So, you can find me on LinkedIn. You could also email me at forkoshd@gmail.com. My website's danielforkosh.com, but that's basically where you can reach out to me.
Well, that's excellent. And I'll put that contact information in the show notes as well. Thank you for your time today, Daniel. This is really interesting to spend some time with you this afternoon. Loved your feedback about the shifting culture in the organizations.
Thanks, guys. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Dan.
You've been listening to the Ardent Development Podcast. Be sure to visit ardentdev.com for the show notes, including links to the resources mentioned. And don't forget to sign up for email notifications so you're the first to know about new episodes. You can also connect with us on the Ardent Development Facebook page or follow us on Twitter at ardentdev. If you enjoyed the show, tell a friend about it. Thanks for listening.